Hi, Activistry.ca is happy to present a recording of Lisa Rumiel's talk, 3 Mile Island to Bhopal, the life and work of environmental activist Rosalie Bertel. It is part of the 2011 History Matters lecture series, sponsored by the Toronto Public Library and the History Education Network. Please check back on Activistry.ca in the near future for recordings of subsequent talks from the 2011 History Matters lecture series.
Thank you very much. In the speech Rosalie Bertel made upon receiving the Right Livelihood Award in 1986, an award that's also known as the Alternative Nobel Peace Prize, she remarked, "Radiation-induced cancers resulting from Chernobyl and the 1,600-plus nuclear weapons explosions or accidents which have already occurred on this planet constitute only a small fraction of the tragedies caused. There will be embryonic, fetal, and infant deaths, congenital diseases and malformations, various degrees of genetic damage to future generations, and a variety of human tragedies officially lumped under the phrase ill health in radiation protection literature. Most of these will not be officially recognized as problems in a world grown callous about random murder by technology." I love this phrase, random murder by technology, so much that I actually, it's the lead title of my dissertation project.
Good for you.
It was this random murder by technology that Rosalie Bertel devoted her activist career to illuminating and preventing, a task which, for several reasons, proved impossible. Her particular concern was with the health effects of low-level radiation exposure from all aspects of the nuclear fuel cycle. So from uranium mining, milling, processing, reprocessing, fabrication, transportation, nuclear accidents, nuclear power production, nuclear weapons testing, and so on and so forth. The debate over low-level radiation exposure has a long history and is a very contentious one. It began in the 1950s over public concerns with the nuclear weapons testing program and the health effects of fallout, which were being detected all around the United States. And in other places in the world as well, and people became concerned about what this fallout was doing to the health of the population. This manifested itself in some really interesting campaigns, like the baby tooth campaign, where mothers were collecting baby teeth and giving them to scientists to study so that they could try to develop a broader understanding of the health effects of fallout. Rosalie Bertel was immersed in the debate from beginning in 1974 and lasting really until today, but really the intense period of her activism was from 1974 to 1994, when she retired from the International Institute of Concern for Public Health. But she did, as I said, remain active after. The debate recently cracked wide open once again with the nuclear reactor accident that happened at Fukushima, an accident which is characterized by the continuous release of these low-level radiation, radioactive byproducts on the Fukushima population. And there's a renewed interest among scientists and funding agencies, and there's going to be a big study of, finally, a longitudinal study that will last for 30 years studying the long-term health effects of low-level radiation exposure. So my research on Rosalie Bertel is part of a much larger project on the role of physicians and scientists in the post-World War II period who were concerned about the health, environmental, and technological risks that were posed by nuclear technology, something that this group of mainly American scientists and physicians who I study argued the risks of these technologies outweighed the benefits that they offered to Americans in terms of national security and domestic security as well. For this talk, I'm just going to talk about Rosalie Bertel, who she was, and also how I think her ideas are relevant today as we are navigating our way out of the current nuclear crisis. And also, before moving forward, this is a lecture series on Toronto environmental history and, go on in, Toronto environmental history and Toronto labor history. And so I thought I should start by placing Rosalie Bertel in that context because in some ways, she doesn't quite fit as well as the other papers in the series because that are really rooted in the communities of the city of Toronto. And Rosalie Bertell, while an American citizen, came to Canada in 1980. It was supposed to be a temporary move to Canada, and she ended up staying here for the remainder of her activist career. And so she was located in Toronto, first at the Jesuit Center for Social Faith and Research, which is now the Jesuit Center for Social Justice, I believe. It changed its name. And she was invited to come here as the resident expert on low-level radiation exposure to focus her activist efforts on advocating on behalf of Indigenous communities that were located in close proximity to nuclear sites around the world and in Canada. And then in 1983, she founded the International Institute of Concern for Public Health with Ursula Franklin, a well-known peace activist in the Voice of Women, and she's a physicist at the University of Toronto, and Dermot McLaughlin, who I believe, someone can correct me, is a radiologist who works in Northern Ontario. There we go. Good Google search confirming that for me today. Yes, and so once she came to Canada in 1980 that she became really immersed in Canadian environmental politics. But she's really an environmental activist of the world. Two nice images of her. I think this is in 1980 and this is in the 1990s. Born in 1929 in Buffalo, New York, she completed an undergraduate degree in mathematics before joining a Carmelite monastery in 1951, where she planned to live a life of prayer in seclusion from the outside world, something that didn't end up happening. And she actually ended up having to leave the monastery in 1956 because the rigors of working in the monastery, the women working there had to do all of the irrigation and physical labor and so on and so forth. It just proved too much for her health, and she actually suffered from congestive heart failure in 1956 at a very young age. And so after she decided after that to go back to school, and she completed a master's degree in mathematics. And then in 1958, she rejoined the Religious Sisterhoods, this time as a member of the Grey Nuns of the Sacred Heart, an order that had a strong history of involvement in community health and education and so on and so forth. So in a lot of, you know, in every way, it really was a good fit for her in the career that she ended up living. And influenced by the changes that were taking place within the Religious Sisterhoods in the 1960s, she opted to go ahead and do a PhD in mathematics, actually in the field of biostatistics at the Catholic University of America, which she completed in 1966. As part of an initiative within the National Institutes of Health, a big granting agency in the United States, to integrate mathematics into the study of biology. So this is where we see the first steps towards the professionalization of epidemiology in the United States becoming a science. So studying patterns of disease in populations using statistical analysis. This was her expertise. And her introduction to radiation health issues began in the early 1970s when she took a job at Roswell Park Memorial Institute in Buffalo, New York as well, where she had been teaching mathematics at the university level for a number of years. And so she worked at Roswell for 8 years as a member of the Tri-State Leukemia Survey, which was a large-scale epidemiological study that tracked 16 million people in a tri-state area from 1959 to 1962. And the question that the study sought to answer was whether or not there was a relationship between increased leukemia rates in these states and routine X-ray procedures, a study that was inspired by Alice Stewart's pioneering work in the 1950s on pregnant women and increased leukemia rates in the offspring of these women. So the study found a positive relationship between low-level radiation from these routine X-ray procedures and increases in leukemia. So this is her introduction. So I mentioned these two aspects of her identity, being a scientist and being a nun, because I think they're really important for understanding her career as an anti-nuclear activist. Both of these aspects of her identity really informed the work that she did throughout her life. So she joined the anti-nuclear movement in 1974 at the age of 45, which, oh, I won't make that joke, which is inspiring for me. I'm 35 years old, and I feel like I still don't quite have a career, you know, but it's okay. She's 45, and she had a wonderful career. So, but she balanced this work for the first 4 years of her activist life with her work at Roswell. So she continued being a scientist and, you know, publishing scientific papers and so on and so forth, doing this research on the Tri-State Leukemia Study. And then in 1978, when she decided to leave Roswell, she established her first nonprofit organization called the Ministry of Concern for Public Health. And a really good illustration, I think, of the importance of religion and science to her identity as an activist is the title of the organization, Ministry of Concern for Public Health. And when she talks about that, she says that her use of the word ministry was her way of literally referencing the ministry that she had chosen for herself in her life, and so public health, marrying that. And so 1974 is a time, so we're experiencing a small resurgence of anti-nuclear activism in Canada, quite a large one in Japan right now. But the 1970s, from relatively 1973 to 1979, were a period of intense social activism, concern on a national scale in the United States and in countries like Germany, Canada as well. Concern over the transition towards relying on nuclear energy technology for the generation of power. And so she becomes an activist in this context. She made the connection between her research on medical x-rays and low-level radiation exposure from commercial nuclear power when she was invited to give to act as an expert witness for a community group in the Niagara region. The Citizens Energy Committee called Roswell Park asking if a scientist on their staff would be willing to come and speak on behalf of this community group that was opposing the establishment of a nuclear power facility in the Niagara County. Drawing upon the data from the Tri-State Survey, Bertel's testimony raised questions about the certainty with which the utility company representatives declared that low-level radiation from nuclear power reactors was harmless to health. Her emphasis on the proximity of the proposed plant to the Cornucopia Farms, and also this, you know, massive concern in the United States, I don't think it was just this one example, about nuclear energy technology and its implications for health and the environment. So these farms grew Gerber baby food, were very powerful in successfully opposing, having the community decide through the legislature to oppose this establishment of a nuclear reactor in this area. So it was her participation in this particular reactor licensing hearing that influenced her to learn about nuclear fission and the history behind the regulation of radiation exposure since World War II. So this is something that she really knew nothing about prior to this time. And the thing that propelled her to continue speaking about the health effects of low-level radiation exposure from nuclear power was her discovery that all regulations that had been safety exposure limits that had been established were based on educated guesses extrapolated from the atomic bomb survivor data and not based on any kind of conclusive scientific research. And so, you know, having her knowledge from the Tri-State study, which was very suggestive that it was a valid question to be pursuing in relation to nuclear power, this is what sort of made her make this decision. There were also push factors that I don't think it was inevitable that she was going to leave her scientific career behind and devote herself to anti-nuclear activism wholesale in the 1970s. There were also some push factors that influenced that decision on her part, and predominantly this was the decision by the National Institutes of Health in 1978, a decision I believe that was announced in 77, to withdraw the funding from the Tri-State Survey. So this is something that historians find really interesting and also people at the time find very interesting, because the decision was made on the recommendation of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which hired a scientist, a very good scientist, who made a very detailed, thorough critique of the tri-state survey as a scientist, but then it sort of got swept up into this political, you know, the policy, the politics and policy and so on and so forth. And upon the recommendation of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is responsible for public health and safety as related to nuclear power, the NIH says, okay, no more money for you, bye-bye. Your 2 decades of study are over. Something that makes it even more fishy is the fact that this happened at the same time that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission decided to take the funding away from 2 other studies on the health effects of low-level radiation exposure in the nuclear industry. One study done by a hematologist in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, named Thomas Nigerian. He had done a study of naval shipyard workers using death certificates, and his conclusion was that these naval shipyard workers had a 450%, make sure I get that correct, 450% higher rate of leukemia death than other members of the population. Another, so his study as well was critiqued by scientists, flaws were pointed out in the study, and he lost his funding. Thomas Mancuso, a very esteemed epidemiologist at the University of Pittsburgh, had been under contract by the Atomic Energy Commission, which preceded the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, since 1964 to do a study of the Hanford Reservation, the workers at the Hanford Reservation. And this study was really, it's a very important study and very unique because he had access, he was the first scientist to have access to worker dosimetry records, so the records of radiation exposure during work time, because this information was classified. And he also, so he used the dosimetry records and the death certificates to draw a similar conclusion, that there was an increased rate of cancer deaths, and so on. So the debate over these decisions was very long and protracted, and I don't have time to really get deeply into them here. But a couple things that I do want to highlight. One, with the exception of Bertel, who, you know, a scientist working for the Tri-State Study, not, she was not the lead scientist on the study. She was politicized before this decision had been made. But after this decision had been made, this politicized very much these other scientists who lost their funding, who felt like they got caught up in the political turmoil of the times, and their careers suffered immensely. I mean, Thomas Mancuso was very close to retirement, but he was essentially pushed into retirement after this happened. So that. As well, the cessation of these studies marked the end of any attempt to understand the long-term health effects of low-level radiation exposure by any federal agency, or at least any study that was public, that people were publicly aware of. The most the Department of Energy agreed to do in 1978 was to fund a 5-year, $10 million follow-up study of naval shipyard workers, which Thomas Mancuso characterized, A, as a conflict of interest and insufficient because the latency period for the development of cancers was 15 to 20 years, and naval shipyards were very young at the time, so insufficient. The fact that the studies were discontinued was used by nuclear proponents, and continues to be used by nuclear proponents, to negate any relationship between low-level radiation exposure and health problems or mortality rates. Only in the context of Fukushima, a disaster, are international granting agencies keen to take up the research questions again. Hence, many unknowns are left as the Japanese people struggle to understand what the accident means for their future. So this is what Bertel essentially devoted her activist career to, or this is what I'm going to talk about. She did eventually branch out beyond nuclear issues to focus her efforts, her activist efforts, on advocating on behalf of communities, for instance, Bhopal, which is in the title of my talk, the Union Carbide plant disaster, the release of chemicals in 1984, which resulted in the death of 15,000 people. So she was very involved in that as well, but this is really where she enters into these kinds of debates. So she devoted her career to getting the issue of low-level radiation exposure, health effects put back on research agendas, and to use the information generated by such research to help people whose health was negatively affected by nuclear technology. And I just want to point out that it's an important important point. It wasn't that nuclear regulators and scientists denied that there was a relationship between low-level radiation exposure and any kind of negative health effects. This is something that is well recognized within scientific literature. Since the early 1970s, the linear no-threshold theory has held the most sway in scientific circles. So it's complicated, but basically the belief that there is no level of radiation exposure that is certifiably safe for anybody. So this is what scientists recognize. But exposure, well, there are some people who believe that, you know, radiation can make you healthy, but they're not in the majority. But exposure safety level standards, while cautious, have always accepted nuclear technology as necessary, hence a certain level of cancers were deemed acceptable. And this is what Bertel disagreed with, this risk versus benefits calculus. The public letter she wrote after Fukushima, I think, is a nice illustration of her thoughts. So she hasn't been very vocal on the webs since Fukushima happened, but she did write this letter in an activist magazine, which has been published in a couple of different places around the web. So here she makes a comparison between medical radiation and radiation exposure from nuclear accidents. There is a great difference between medical uses of radiation with direct risk and benefit to a patient in the random distribution of a comparable dose to a large population. In the latter case, the risk is magnified and the benefit goes to filling some general society benefit. Hence, the individual harm may be sacrificed for the military or economic good of a country. How or why we must make this trade-off has never been well understood by the public or well explained and agreed to by reasonable civil society. Her activism focused on three different things. So she was very mostly involved in raising awareness about nuclear issues, and so giving public addresses around the world in Canada, across the United States, in Japan, in the Marshall Islands, in Australia, New Zealand, all over Europe. And this is really this was her main source of income when she was active full-time as an anti-nuclear activist. This was how she sustained her work. Speaking in all forms of media and participating in international human rights campaigns as well. She also acted as an expert witness in various different forums, mainly nuclear reactor licensing hearings during the 1970s, before we were no longer doing nuclear reactor licensing hearings. Well, now we're doing them again. And then also testifying on behalf of people who were trying to seek reparations from their governments for radiation damage. So the Atomic Veterans, for instance, she did testimony there. And she also organized community health studies along the lines of popular epidemiology, a type of scientific study that's performed by communities. So communities taking their health into their own hands, studying their health through surveying and through the cooperation with sympathetic scientists, and with the goal of using that information as a political tool or as something that can be used in litigation. One of the things I find really interesting about Rosalie Bertel is analyzing the ways she operated in these different contexts. When giving expert testimony, she always worked very hard to portray herself as a conventionally professional scientist, keeping her commentary limited to discussions of her tri-state research and other scientific studies that illuminated the negative genetic and health effects of low-level radiation exposure. A good illustration of this is the testimony that she gave in 1979 in Byron, Illinois, at the reactor licensing hearing of Commonwealth Edison. This is a hearing that took place just after the Three Mile Island accident, or it could have happened before, but anyways, it got caught up in Three Mile Island and it was rejected. So her testimony focused specifically on the environmental impact statement of the utility company, emphasizing the complexity of radiation health assessments and the utility company's failure to acknowledge them. According to her, the company failed to adequately consider how nuclear reactors might impact the health of different people. So people, you know, children versus the elderly versus people who have chronic health problems, people who are healthy, pregnant women, and so on and so forth. This was not something that was incorporated into the environmental impact statement that the industry had done. She also encouraged Commonwealth Edison to account for the unknown health effects of radiation exposure, ones that were not considered linked to radiation exposure because they were never studied. So, raising awareness about the issue of, you know, just because there hasn't been scientific research done does not mean that there are not things that we should be concerned about. And maybe utility companies should participate in generating knowledge about these things. And then this is the third thing that she wanted to impress upon them. a critique of the licensing procedure as a whole, which treated decisions about whether or not to open up a new reactor on a case-by-case basis, that didn't consider nuclear sites that were located anywhere in close proximity. So in this particular case, the Byron reactors, it was the Byron Nuclear Generating Station already had two reactors operating. You see them here. This is a Illinois state map, partial map. And the two black triangles there are the two Byron reactors, and then the two sad little triangles facing down are the ones that ended up unsuccessful, that they were not successful applications. But you see all of these, we have other operating reactors in close proximity, a contaminated non-operational reactor, as well as high-level radioactive waste sites just here in the south, low-level radioactive waste sites, and so on and so forth. And she said, and she, you know, just sort of was poking holes in the logic of this case-by-case decision-making and saying, why aren't we thinking about this as a whole, and why aren't we assessing people's health in this whole? Her public addresses were where she freely wove her scientific concerns around personal commentary on nuclear technology, war, patriarchy, ecofeminism, faith, and all kinds of other issues. Consider, for example, a keynote address that she made in 1983 at the Nuclear Free and Independent Pacific Conference. Militarization is a cancer on the human species, which will kill us all if it is not itself destroyed. Develop a capacity for love and for healing. Clearly reject death and killing, whether it is within a nation or between nations, whether one kills the future inhabitants of the earth or the most helpless and voiceless members of the global community. Together, it may be possible to save a remnant. Alone, each of us is powerless and helpless. So this is why I love Rosalie Bertell. I'm not supposed to say that because I'm an objective historian, but I always say that anytime I talk about her. So this is one of the things I find so interesting about Rosalie Bertell, the scientist activist. And I think it's because I study all of these other scientist activists and physician activists who were much more cautious in the ways that they presented themselves because they had these images to uphold. And this is something very irregular for a scientist to say. And one of the things I argue in my larger work is that it's this alternative community of belonging that she has in a women's religious order that freed her to make, you know, to sort of create an identity like this that really tried to marry the two aspects of her identity, this sort of passionate, not so concerned with sounding very, you know, cautious and conservative in her assessments of the problem, and then a very incisive knowledge of radiation health issues. So that's why I find her, one of the reasons I find her really interesting. Another thing she freely incorporated into public discussions about nuclear technology was her belief that women, or maternal values, had a special role to play in getting us back on track as a civilization. This is linked, I think, to her religious vows, and as well to her ecofeminist beliefs. This is a period in time where those two things meshed very nicely in this historical context. In the final chapter of her book, No Immediate Danger, which if anybody is interested later, they can buy a copy of. There you go, I worked it in. She wrote in the final chapter, titled A Time to Bloom, Traditionally charged with birthing and assisting the dying, women have been generally more attuned than men to the signs of sickness and death in the Earth's biosphere. And so this ethic, this belief, really informed a lot of what she did. So the community health study model that she developed brought together her scientific expertise and her social and political values into something concrete, that she a concrete piece of her work. So I just wanted to give you a couple of examples of the community health studies that she did, something so that you can just visualize them, but I won't go into depth about them. So one of the community health studies that she did was in a community in the early 1980s in Canonsburg, Pennsylvania, located up here on the map there. And so this is a map of the Department of Energy cleanup remediation sites of uranium tailing places where uranium tailings are located across the United States in various stages of cleanup remediation. So Canonsburg, which is one of the only sites in the United States where surface and groundwater cleanup has either, it's ongoing or it hasn't started. It says ongoing, but I don't know the definitive answer to that. But anyway, so she was involved in a community health study focused specifically on a local school in Canonsburg or surrounding Canonsburg that was located adjacent to this mill tailing site, because it was discovered that some of the children in the school had lead, the element lead 210, in their urine. And so the community, which had several sisters who were working in the school, contacted Rosalie Bertel, and she went in with another scientist from a chemist, I believe, from University of Waterloo named Harry Sharma, who went and performed a community health study of this group. So it gives you a sense of sort of the impact that she's able to make as an individual. You know, this is one community, and these are all of this is just uranium tailings. She also was really involved in health studies, in particular the Mississauga First Nation, which is located near Blind River in northern Ontario. So in this area here, where we have the largest uranium refinery in Canada, as well as a former uranium mine. And I put this map here just so that you could see where it is on the map, but also to make the point about the location. So all of the yellow dots are the nuclear power reactors in Canada, and then the rest are various uranium facilities. So I wanted to just have you visualize the geography of these places and how they're located mainly in remote areas, close proximity to Indigenous populations in Canada, in Inuit and Aboriginal populations. There's another proposed mine that's not on there, Baker Lake, which it's in the same, you know, north of Manitoba there. So this is how, or you know, one of the reasons why Rosalie Bertel became really involved in these communities. And then here, another really a study where she made a really important contribution, I think, was in the Rongelap reassessment study, assessing the health of the people of the Rongelap Atoll in the Marshall Islands located. So this top image here, you see in the corner where it says Ground Zero, that's Bikini Atoll, and that was where the 1954 hydrogen bomb test, Casa Bravo, took place on March 1st. The population of Bikini was evacuated prior to the test, but the populations on the atolls downwind, where they hadn't anticipated that fallout would travel, weren't evacuated until, I think, 3 days later. So the Rongelap atoll, and the circles are just the different concentrations of fallout that traveled this direction. So we have Rongelap atoll, Rongerik, as well as Ningime atoll. And then we have here, this is a young boy, photos taken of him 92 hours, I believe, after the Bravo shot and these are the burns that are to his body. So very, you know, intense physical damage. And so Rosalie Bertel was involved in the 1980s in a community, another community health study that was designed to try and get the United States government to basically give these people reparations and take responsibility for the damage that they had done to the populations. So, while she never explicitly attached the word feminist to the community health study model that she developed, it was an exemplar of what feminist philosophers of science meant when they advocated an approach to science during the same period of time in the 1980s. An approach to science that embraced subjectivity and maternal qualities like intuition, empathy, and care in the everyday work of science. The articulation of a feminist approach to science stemmed from the ecofeminist belief that things like detachment, reason, empiricism, qualities which are central to the way scientific objectivity is defined, promoted the destruction of the environment and the subjugation of women. Bertel's interest was in making sure women's and other marginalized groups' experiences served as the starting point for scientific inquiry. The studies were also designed to encourage community involvement, and they were intended to be used as political tools. Two things that are very much contrary to accepted scientific practice. Modern epidemiological studies, so her studies were really a critique of modern epidemiological studies. One of the reasons that it was a critique was because as epidemiology became recognized as a science, adopting laboratory models of study, they required a 95% assurance ratio, so that health problems were the statistical probability that health problems had been caused by a particular whatever was 95%. And this demand that these studies were growing larger and larger and larger so that findings of only statistical significance could be found. Popular epidemiologists argue that the absence of statistically significant findings does not negate findings of public health significance. Basically, not being able to statistically validate the health complaints of a number of people does not negate that their complaints are legitimate and or that polluting industries are causing them. And so this is really the philosophy that underlay her development of these community health studies. So to conclude, ultimately, Bertel was a small fish in a big pond. Her efforts to radicalize public health recording and promote a feminist approach to science that disaggregated actual people from the statistical models used to determine the health effects of radiation exposure had a negligible impact on either the practice of science or decision-making about our ever-expanding reliance on nuclear technology. And if someone wants to argue with me about that, that's good. Maybe I'm just too pessimistic. However, considered in the context of the Fukushima nuclear disaster that continues to unfold in Japan, her philosophical critique of science and science policy is still compelling. While her claims about the relationship between low-level radiation exposure and cancer and genetic defects were consistent with the linear no-threshold theory, she refused to accept the epidemiologic, that's my word, that determined low-dose exposures need not necessarily be a cause for concern because of the statistically small number of people affected. Applied to Fukushima, this thinking essentially writes off as insignificant the people who will develop cancer and other health problems as a result of the reactor meltdowns. Even the new research into the long-term health effects of low-level radiation exposure that the accident has inspired will do nothing to mitigate the health effects that people will experience. A middle ground, like the one proposed by Bertel, where scientific, moral, and or feminist values brings actual people into focus, people whose lives have already been terribly affected by nuclear technology. The Fukushima nuclear reactor meltdowns also reinforced the legitimacy of Bertel's wholesale opposition to nuclear technology, something you would be hard-pressed to find a scientist today to do, especially one who's working in a university or a research laboratory or the equivalent. The reasons for this are many. For example, scientists are trained to hone in on their particular research problems, too often to the exclusion of the bigger picture into which their research fits. In the context of radioactive contaminants, the complexity of understanding their health effects and scientists' preoccupation with the purity of the scientific method often obscures rather than elucidates their effects. Likewise, scientists are trained to be suspicious of engagement with political movements, but the same level of distrust is not equally extended to association with government and military-funded research, and there are like very practical reasons for this. Governments and militaries pay pretty well. Yet if we zoom out to consider the Fukushima nuclear reactor meltdowns in the broader context of the nuclear age, for example, it is one of at least four major nuclear reactor accidents in the past 54 years, each of which happened under unique and impossible circumstances, it teaches us that the nuclear industry is not prepared to deal with the unknowns, an insight that I'm stealing from Hugh Gusterson, who's really written some really wonderful stuff on nuclear issues. If we zoom out even further and look at the larger history of environmental contamination from all aspects of nuclearism, both military and commercial, continued arguments in favor of expanding our reliance on nuclear technology sound absurd. At least they do to me. It was humanistic observations such as these that Bertel's immersion in a women's religious order, the ecofeminist social justice and anti-nuclear movements influenced her to step back and do. Thank you.
You've been listening to a recording of Lisa Ramil's talk, 3 Mile Island to Bhopal, the life and work of environmental activist Rosalie Bertel. It is part of the 2011 History Matters lecture series sponsored by the Toronto Public Library and the History Education Network. Please check back on activehistory.ca in the near future for recordings of subsequent talks from the 2011 History Matters lecture series.